And then I went off to teach at a small college in Wisconsin. And I was there for 2 years. And I started doing research right away on one of kind of a Bloomer-like project, which had to do with daydreaming.
With?
Daydreaming.
It's fantasy. And this is significant in my biography because I had this wonderful data from kids I had daydreaming in front of me, but I didn't know what to do with it because the ordinary sociological techniques didn't tell me how to do it, and all the social psychological scales didn't tell me what to do with it, and I didn't know what to do with it, and Bloomer had no methods at all. He just told you to go out and do something.
Mm-hmm.
And even
he
the
was phenomenologically oriented in his methods.
Well,
or he
did he do
empirical research?
He did, I think, one study on children looking at movies, but it wasn't very good.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise,
it was more theoretical.
Very theoretical.
Mm-hmm.
Programmatic.
Theoretical, very programmatic. And very critical of other positions, and he was quite good in his way.
Yeah.
You know. Actually, he never changed over the years. If you read the book that he published in 1969, when he became rediscovered again in his old age, it's very much what he was teaching 30 years before.
Yeah.
So you became your own teacher? You had no methods?
Well, I didn't know what to do with it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I didn't publish it. When I did Mares and Mayus, I had a section on daydreams in it. But I really didn't quite know what to do with all this material. The next place I went to was to Indiana University. And I taught there for 6 years. And that was significant, again, biographically, because there was a guy there by the name of Alfred Lindesmith, it's all one word. And he was an expert in addiction.
Addiction?
He had done a thesis and a book on opiate addiction,
mm-hmm.
which was a very powerful...
Opium addiction.
It's a very powerful book.
Yeah.
And he had developed a method, which is called analytic induction. I think was first talked about maybe by Zanetsky, but it's based on 19th century physics, really, which is you have a universal hypothesis, and every case has to fit. And if it negates the hypothesis, you know, that's terrible. You have to somehow incorporate it somehow. And what he did is he had this hypothesis about how people became addicted, and then he looked for all the literature and could find no exceptions. And I used to argue with him because I said, you know, you can't do sociology that way. It's just not practical. Most of our problems don't fit that kind of a model. But he was also a social psychologist, and so we wrote a book together.
Yeah, on field research.
No. We wrote a book. Field research comes in later.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We wrote a book called Social Psychology.
Yeah, it's translated in German. I have it.
You're right.
A bad translation. We corresponded about that.
Right.
Yeah.
And this book, at the time, people who were writing textbooks in social psychology were both sociologists and psychologists. And they were quite good people. And this was a time when you wrote a textbook that wasn't just to make money and to reach a lot of undergraduates. People put their ideas into these textbooks.
Yeah.
And that's why we wrote this book. But we didn't know it, but it made us famous.
Yeah,
because
and it has been republished within the last years, I think.
Yeah, I know it got translated into Swedish and German, Japanese, maybe some other places, I don't know.
I heard about a new edition in the 80s, an English edition.
It still goes on. We invited Norman Denzin to be a junior author in 72 or 73.
Yeah.
We sat here on the deck and we rewrote it while they were showing the Watergate proceedings on the television.
Yeah.
We would run back and forth and see what was that we would report it. And Denzin keeps republishing it. I haven't I haven't looked at it for 20 years almost. But you know, it's totally outmoded. But there's still a few people who buy it.
For me, it was very interesting to read it because we have not this sociological orientation in psychology, and there's so much material within that book about definition, of about naming. You see,
well, let me explore this for you, because I think this would be interesting maybe for your audience.
Yeah.
In 1908, or thereabouts, there were two books published, and in a way they're symbolic. One was by McDougall, which was all about instincts.
Mm-hmm.
Another was by Ross, who was influenced by collective psychology in France.
Mm-hmm.
People, I guess, like...
Le Bon.
Le Bon, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, completely different. Now, Ross himself was not a large influence on sociology after he died, but Thomas, W.A. Thomas, was a social psychologist very early and widely read in ethnography of the day, and also very deeply influenced by Dewey.
Mm.
So he was all of these things in one.
And he taught at Chicago.
He taught at Chicago
until
18 or 19, and then Chicago fired him in a famous scandal.
Mm-hmm.
He was a pacifist, and the Chicago Tribune decided they would get rid of this guy. And so they faked the photograph, or whether it was true, showing him coming out of the house of a woman whose husband was a soldier fighting.
Mm.
Something like that. It was a big scandal, but he was in Chicago at the time he published this famous Polish Peasant, and so his social psychology was built into the Chicago tradition. And then a guy by the name of Robert Park, who is the big charismatic person in the 20s, who was really the father of all these interactionists, was brought there by Thomas. And his style was different than Thomas, but it had many of the same aspects. So social psychology was built into Chicago sociology, but they didn't necessarily make sharp distinctions between sociology and social psychology. And when Blumer wrote his thesis, he wrote a thesis on social psychology. What he did is he looked at all the textbooks and all the writings by psychologists and sociologists, but he called it social psychology, which is interesting. So when I was in Chicago, I thought of myself as a social psychologist as well as a sociologist.
Yeah.
But notice I also had this background in anthropology. But when I went to Indiana to teach, and I wanted to teach a course in social psychology, the psychologists would let me do that because they were teaching social psychology. So Linda Smith and I had a class called Culture, what was it called? Personality and Society or something like that.
We created something new.
We created, I taught Chicago-style social psychology. And then I caught a class in personality in which I criticized all these people writing about personality, including not only the psychologists, but some of the biologists and a couple of the sociologists who were almost like sociobiologists. And when I went to Chicago, I taught that same class. But in Chicago, I could teach social psychology. It didn't make any difference to the psychologists. But there were these two different traditions. The psychology one really began effectively with Floyd Alport, who wrote a text, what, about 1921, 22. And at the time when I became educated. There were people like Newcomb, who were very well known. And what they were trying to do is they were trying to carve out a niche in American psychology for their field, which was social psychology. They were trying to make it scientific, like the rest of psychology. At the same time, they were borrowing somewhat from our side of the fence. So there were these two streams were going on in these different fields. And I can emphasize this again by saying that I was asked in 1954 to write an article for by a psychologist for a big volume. He was writing this compendium of articles. He was asking people to write articles about psychology. And one of his volumes had to do with psychology and other disciplines. So he asked me to write an article on psychology and sociology. And I said, I can't do that. I don't know that much about all of sociology and all of its contacts with psychology. Mm-hmm. But I can write about social psychology. So I wrote an article on social psychology where I pointed out these two different things. And since I was studying it and teaching classes in the sociology of work and occupations, I did which directions they were facing in terms of allies and opponents. And it was a period where there was a fair amount of overlap between some of the psychologists and sociologists. But I said, they're different. And then I went off to Germany. When I came back, I discovered that he had published his book, but I wasn't in it.
Oh.
He had asked the functionalist sociologist who wrote an article on this. And, you know, I've laughed ever since. But I think it's very illustrative of some of the distance between those two sides. And I think what happened is that in the 60s and 70s, the contact was broken. And it was, probably isn't that much anymore. Yet, to complete this story, I had a call a month ago from a man who represents a section in sociology called Section on Social Psychology. There is a section, and there is a journal, which I'm sure you know. And he said, we have just met as a group, and we want to give you the award, the annual award of the year. I said, I haven't done social psychology for 25 years, and I don't read your journal. And he said, you're not exceptional. And his view of social psychology was like micro-sociology. You've done enough micro-sociology so that we think of you as a social psychologist, which isn't my view of social psychology at all. Mm. So I don't know that that's useful to you, but there are differences between the...
Yeah. Differences
and rivalry or competition? You say competition, concurrence?
Rivalry.
Yeah.
I don't know. See, I haven't followed it since 1930. So I really don't know. I read a lot of psychology in the 40s and early 50s, but then I went off and did other things.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Now the method part, which is I think is what you're interested in, goes like this, that